in the matter of Whalen versus Armstrong International. Can we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Mr. Morano, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. As plaintiff's letter indicated, I'll be addressing the issues encompassed in the defendant's joint supplemental brief, as well as any Ford-specific questions you might have, and my co-counsel will address any questions you might have about their particular issues or their particular products. This case comes down to a single proposition of law that can be approached from two different directions. The first is that a manufacturer does not have an obligation to warn of friable asbestos that it did not make or sell. The second is that a plaintiff in an asbestos case cannot prove medical causation without proving regular, frequent, and proximate exposure to friable asbestos made or sold by the defendant. But both of those positions reach the same result, which is that defendants here are not liable for Mr. Whalen's disease to the extent they were caused by replacement asbestos parts that they did not make or sell. On the question of duty, the appellate division below created a hybrid negligence and strict liability cause of action. It's negligence because it expands liability on negligence principles. It expands liability to the extent that manufacturers know that their products will be used in a certain way and have certain parts replaced with certain other parts. But it restricts the defenses that are available to manufacturers on strict liability grounds. It prevents them from arguing that perhaps the reason they may have required asbestos parts in their devices was because they were not aware of and could not have been aware of the dangers of asbestos at the relevant time period. And what Bishada teaches, and this court has followed Bishada for over three decades, despite repeated invitations to overturn it, is that in the asbestos context, and only the asbestos context, we have true strict liability in New Jersey. True strict liability in the sense that Bishada said conduct does not matter. What the manufacturer knew does not matter. What the manufacturer could have known does not matter. Instead, the sole focus is on the product. And in true strict liability, the focus is on the chain of distribution, who made the asbestos and who sold the asbestos. But because the defendants here did not make or sell the asbestos that is alleged to have harmed Mr. Whalen, or at least as found by the appellate division, and we acknowledge there's a fact-bound dispute below about whether he was exposed to original asbestos from these defendants, there should not be a duty to warn because of the balance that this court has struck and has continued to adhere to for the last three decades, which is to say that the appellate division cases that the appellate division relied on, Seeley and Marino, those were cases where liability would be imposed for the combination of two products, which together caused the harm to the plaintiff, only if the manufacturer knew or could have known of the danger of the combination. But under Bishada, that kind of knowledge-based inquiry does not matter. And that's where those two cases go astray.
So take out the knowledge. Let's say that the only replacement part was an asbestos-laden gasket. Forget about knowledge of the manufacturer. That's all there is. They manufacture a machine. When it leaves their factory, it has an asbestos-laden gasket, and the only replacement part possible is an asbestos-laden gasket. Forget about knowledge. You okay with that standard?
No, Your Honor.
I didn't think so.
At least where the replacement part is not manufactured by the defendant. And, of course, some defendants do sell replacement parts, and we're liable to the extent we make or sell the asbestos. But, again, what Bishada said is we are going to focus on the product. We are going, and I think from Schultz's you get, we're going to focus on the asbestos. And we're going to say, if it's your asbestos, doesn't matter whether you knew, doesn't matter whether you could have known, doesn't matter whether you required replacement parts, If it's your asbestos, you're going to be held strictly liable for it. And Bishotta did that for a reason, because it thought it was helping plaintiffs. Because instead of having a typical product liability case, where you might have a debate about what manufacturers knew and what they could have known and all these sort of fact-laden questions, it would instead come down to a relatively simple inquiry.
What about if the original gasket is also asbestos, the one that came with the product? Still no liability because you didn't manufacture that?
So if the gasket that causes the harm is the one that was sold originally with the product, we have liability for that because we are liable for not just the machine we sell, but also all the parts that are contained within it. We accept that.
And if the only replacement gaskets available are also asbestos laden, any liability then, even though you didn't manufacture those any more than you did the one in your machine? What is the distinction there?
The distinction is it comes from strict liability. Strict liability looks at the chain of distribution. And I understand this seems counterintuitive in a certain way because, you know, since strict liability was, I think, first developed, strict liability, I think, has migrated to a negligence and strict liability hybrid. In fact, what this court said in Feldman is at a certain point, strict liability failure to warn is just a negligence cause of action at the end of the day, except in asbestos. And I think that's the point I want to continue to make, which is except in asbestos.
Well, the Maryland case kept the idea of the negligence theory separate from strict liability. And they were careful there not to extend it to every time there would be a replacement part that was going to contain the noxious component, such as asbestos, that would have to be replaced. They kept it more narrow. Why shouldn't that model not fit as the next step that is consistent with the theory in Bethesda?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because the Maryland case also requires the plaintiff to show the defendant knew or could have known of the dangers of the replacement parts. And that's the same thing, by the way, that Dummett does up in New York. Where, and in fact, what Dummett noted was...
But wait a minute, why should that matter? Our law already says we take a certain approach to asbestos. We know that manufacturers didn't know about the dangerousness of asbestos up to a certain point in time, but we're still applying liability. So we don't have to back away from that in order to adopt the next step of the analysis that the Maryland court has done, do we?
I mean, I think what you then do in the next step is you start looking at things like what did people know about the use and the combination.
Well, let's talk about your client. Your client manufactured replacement drums for brakes that contained asbestos, didn't they?
Well, the drums don't contain asbestos. The linings do. The brake linings do.
Yeah.
And actually, Ford is not a manufacturer of brake linings. The brake lining that might come in a Ford box was actually manufactured by someone else, but of course we accept that we have liability.
But I thought in the facts that were agreed to that 25% did come from Ford, including the asbestos part.
My understanding of the facts, Your Honor, and part of what we're doing today is we're not asking the court to sort of go through 5,000 pages of an appendix. But
well,
is
it's
that
only
Ford,
for purposes of whether there's enough of a fact question to justify going to trial over these questions. We're not resolving them today.
No, absolutely. I don't think you should, Your Honor. But I do think, Your Honor, that Ford did not actually manufacture brakes. It sold certain brakes under a Ford logo. And, of course, as the seller of those brakes, we accept that we're liable.
Okay. So you knew that the liners had to be replaced for the disc brakes. You knew the drums had to be replaced on the rear brakes. And you know those components would wear out, and that would be a natural use of the product that you put into the chain of commerce. So why is that not consistent with the approach that's being taken in Maryland when you know that the replacement parts for your overall product requires use of that noxious component?
Well, I think it comes down to the word you continue to use, which is what we know. And our submission today is that knowledge is irrelevant and should be irrelevant under Bishotta. No part of an asbestos strict liability failure to warn case should turn on what the defendant knows.
You knew the product would continue to be used, and you knew the product had a certain construct. That's the knowledge that I'm talking about, not specific knowledge about asbestos. We are past that. I agree. And I'm not suggesting that the court turn back from that step in its liability analysis.
Well, I think two answers. One, that I would say that not just knowledge of dangers, knowledge altogether shouldn't be part of the strict liability case, because part of Bishotta was about simplifying the asbestos liability trial.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we start talking about at trial, you know, what did Ford know about how things would be replaced? Did it know that it had to be asbestos linings as opposed to non-asbestos linings? particularly once you've taken away a defense, by the way, that part of the reason it may have thought there had to be asbestos linings is because it didn't believe there were dangers at the time, you've taken away what Bashada was supposed to give to the strict liability asbestos analysis, which is simplification. And second, I think what I'd point out is that Bashada struck a balance. Bashada struck a balance between if it's your asbestos, you are liable for it, full stop. But the flip side of Bashada, and I think this ties into the Schultz's part of the analysis, is it has to be your asbestos, not somebody else's asbestos, not your car plus somebody else's asbestos. You're liable for your asbestos. And that is a system that has served New Jersey perfectly well for 30 years.
Schultz said a plaintiff must establish, in addition to other elements of a product liability action, exposure to friable asbestos manufactured or distributed by the defendant.
That's
correct.
Right.
And that has never been diverged from in asbestos cases.
No.
And in fact, New Jersey product liability law is based on the premise that there is liability if you're the manufacturer, if you're the distributor, if you include it as a component of your own product, very broad liability if you are in the chain of distribution. But has there ever been a case that has, other than successor liability types of cases, that has imposed liability on a manufacturer because of a later added product manufactured by somebody else?
Not that I'm aware of, outside of the Sealy Molino type situation.
Right, and that's, as you've talked about, a different analysis there.
That's absolutely right.
So this would be a major change for New Jersey product liability law, would it not?
It would. It would completely, I think, change the Middlesex multi-county liability asbestos doctrine. I mean, for three decades.
But isn't it really how we define the product? If the product is the whole thing, which includes the essential component part that it requires, it's expendable and requires replacement. If it's the whole product, and you have to admit there was asbestos in brake linings in the car when it was first sold, so we know that it's part of the whole thing, and it does require a replacement. If we keep that definition of product, then regardless of whether there is a replacement part that is not manufactured by you, you might know who that other manufacturer is and can point to them, but you knew that it had to be replaced.
Well, you know, I would reject the premise, Your Honor,
the
which is that we're trying to...
The product is not asbestos, is what I'm suggesting. It's not a more narrow definition of product.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the appellate division below conceived of this as what is the product. But that's not what Schultz says. There was there's the quote that Justice Patterson gave, and two other quotes I'll give you, too. To prevail against a particular defendant in an asbestos case, a plaintiff must establish, in addition to the other, that was, I think, the first one, at summary judgment motion, plaintiff only need to produce evidence from which a fact finder, after assessing proof of frequency and intensity of plaintiff's contacts with a particular manufacturer's friable asbestos. And then the third one, what is principally concerned us here is that each plaintiff's exposure to each defendant's asbestos was a proximate cause. So it's not product. In fact, when the word product is used, it's typically been used with asbestos product. So the focus should be on the friable asbestos. So to conceive of this as what is the product, and then we can think of the product as the brake drum, then the car, then, you know, on outward, is to take away from what Schultz has said three different times, which is the friable asbestos.
So let's talk about product. When an automobile manufacturer sends a vehicle onto the roadway, is the product the vehicle or the brake lining?
I mean,
let's forget about asbestos. There's a defective brake system. Are you telling me that Chrysler or Ford is not going to be responsible, even though the supplier may be someone who gave Ford or Chrysler the brake lining to put into the car?
Absolutely not, Justice.
Okay, so the brake lining would be a component part of the vehicle, an integral part of the vehicle, correct?
It's not going to stop without it.
Yes? Yes, if it's defective. Okay. Let's say the defect is asbestos. Why does the analysis change? Why is that not still a component, integral part of the car?
And if it is the asbestos that comes with the car when it first goes on the road, we accept we're responsible for that.
Moment of leaving the manufacturer or the distributor's premises is the critical moment for product liability.
That's absolutely right. When it leaves
in Justice Albin's example, the defective brake lining left your premises, your client's premises in hypothetical,
And you're responsible for the defect, or, you know, along with potentially the manufacturer of the brake lining.
Absolutely.
But if the product is a used car and is used for 10 years and the brakes are replaced and somebody puts a defective set of brakes in there, you don't have liability because they were not part of your product when it left your premises.
That's
correct?
Exactly our argument.
But let's take that. But let's say the defect that is in the car, an integral part of the car, is asbestos lining brakes. And the way you've constructed your vehicle, the only replacement is more asbestos lining brakes. Why not under Bishada and its accidents avoidance and risk spreading doctrines, should the obligation be on you to put some warning saying asbestos, the brake linings have asbestos on it?
So because
they'll always have asbestos on it because you've created a car that requires asbestos lined brake linings.
So let me take cost sharing and accident avoidance in reverse order. First, what Bishada says about cost sharing is that those who profit from the defective product should be the ones that share the cost. Well, the people who profited from asbestos brake linings are people who made asbestos brake linings.
Ford too. You're selling the car. You can't sell the car without the brake line. You're not making a profit from it.
We're making a profit from car, but not from the thing that is defective, which is the asbestos brake line.
You can't roll the car out onto the roadway without the brakes. You're going to make a profit without having brakes in a car?
Well, and to the extent the harm is caused by the brake linings that Ford put out with the car, they're liable for that. But when it comes to the replacement linings, and I'll represent the facts on the ground, are that oftentimes brakes are replaced with linings that don't come from Ford, that Ford is not profiting from. It's those manufacturers that should be the ones that share the risk.
There's no claim in this case, is there, that there was a design defect insofar as there was a way to make the car without brake linings that were lined with asbestos?
That's right. It's a failure to warn claim.
So it's entirely failure to warn. So there's no claim that Ford designed the car in a defective manner because it could have designed the car without asbestos brake linings, but it didn't.
That claim is not a liability claim in this case. Purely failure
to warn.
That's right, Your Honor.
So we're talking about imposing on Ford a liability for failure to warn of the dangers of a product that wasn't made yet, potentially, when the car left its premises and was not installed and was somebody else's product.
And I think that's absolutely right, Justice Patterson. And so the cause of action that's created by the appellate division below is not just a hybrid of strict liability and negligence. It's also almost just a hybrid of design defect plus failure to warn, which says that because you designed your product in such a way that it has to have replacement asbestos brake linings, that is an additional reason we are going to impose liability.
Where does the warning go? Practically speaking, this is a failure to warn case. Okay, you're representing the manufacturer. Where does the sticker go? The failure to warn.
It can go on the box of the replacement part. In fact, most plaintiffs who bring these claims are tradesmen like Mr. Whalen, who isn't coming into contact with somebody's, manual that's sitting in their glove box. What they come into contact with are the box they pick up that has the replacement brake linings in it. So a warning can go there. Also, in terms of accidents avoidance, I should point out that whatever you hold today, nobody is going to be made more or less safe. None of these defendants use asbestos in their products anymore. This is about continuing to shift liability and finding out who pays. And
what's wrong with the manufacturer bringing in the distributor? You're in many, many years later, decades later. Isn't Ford in a better position to know who its suppliers are than the plaintiff? There's nothing preventing you from impleading the suppliers.
Oh, quite the opposite, Justice Altman, which is the person who's going to know what parts he worked with as a tradesman, or Mr. Whalen.
Just to be clear, this is not your supplier. If you had a supplier of brakes, that was in your original car. We're not talking about somebody supplying Ford
That's absolutely right.
Yeah. So
I mean, he might have gone to Pet Boys for his brakes. He might have gone, I don't know, nobody knows where he went for his brakes or where he brought the asbestos-laden cement that he allegedly worked with. So we can't plead those people because he can't identify them. In fact, the reason that Mr. Whalen is suing us is because he can't identify the manufacturers of the products he worked with. But he says, well, I worked on a Crown Boiler, or I worked on a Ford car. And I think that really emphasizes the expansion of liability that plaintiff is requesting here, which is that for three decades, People at New Jersey Asbestos Discovery Depositions have been trying to figure out product identification. You know, you worked with stuff as a tradesman. What did you work with? And I guess what plaintiff's position is, for 30 years, they've all been wrong. It's all just been a sucker's bet, because what they should have been doing is suing the boiler makers and the car manufacturers.
But I think their argument is this. You've created a product, the automobile, that requires, and I'm just going to use this for shorthand, a poisonous substance in order for it to run properly. That was in the original. And every replacement part was also going to be poisonous. And they're saying that you, having created this product that's requiring this very dangerous replacement part, should be at least one of the entities that should be giving notice. What's wrong about that?
I think what's wrong about that, among other things, is it sounds a lot like a design defect claim, Justice Albin. And if it were a design defect claim, then we would bring in all of the other things which said, you know, gosh, that there was no other way to make cars back then, let's say.
There's a form of liability under our law that says there's a design defect, and what's defective about the design is there was an alternative, safer design.
That's absolutely
along
right,
with risk utility, that's
plaintiffs
available.
Don't bring those claims.
And those are very common claims.
And they're common in other contexts,
but not
asbestos. Is failure to warn. It's almost always failure to warn.
What, if any, lessons can be drawn from the holding in DeVries? I know that it's limited specifically to the maritime tort context, but does its logic in any way extend to a case like this?
I don't think so, Mr. Chief Justice, because, again, it relies on the notion, it again relies on a hybridization of negligence and strict liability. I mean, both the majority and even Justice Gorsuch's dissent, where he thinks there might be some instances. It requires the plaintiff to show that the defendant knew or could have known of the dangers of the combination of the two products. And, in, you know, in states where a plaintiff carries that burden, maybe things are different. I don't know. But, you know, you have Dummett that was actually quite clear on this. They said the reason we feel comfortable extending liability on these facts, whereas other states do not, is because we have a state-of-the-art defense. We require to show knowledge. So it's really a lot more like a negligence cause of action. But that's not what New Jersey has. New Jersey picked a lane in Machado. And I understand that a lot of the questions we're getting today, I think in many ways are influenced by the fact that over the recent decades, we're used to strict liability being essentially a negligence cause of action. I think what you have to do is you have to take yourself back to Dean Prosser and everybody else who, when they first thought of strict liability, it was, if it's your product and if it hurts people, you're liable.
Would you explain a little bit about state-of-the-art and what happened to state-of-the-art in Bichotta for asbestos cases?
Sure. So state-of-the-art is essentially the defense that says that we did not know of the product's danger, and we could not have scientifically known of the product's danger. And Bichotta said, too bad, essentially. Even if it were scientifically impossible to know of the product's danger, you are still liable, because what we want to say is it's about cost sharing and it's about simplification of trials. It's about ensuring that, you know, and remember, at that time, asbestos cases look a lot different than they do today. These were the guys in the shipyards. It was truly a crisis. And I think Bichotta took the position that the way we're going to make this simpler in New Jersey is by having a, is it your product? Did it hurt you? What are your damages? But then in Feldman, what this court said is, because the argument was then made, well, why shouldn't that be all product liability in New Jersey? And this court in Feldman said, no, we're not going to do that, because outside of asbestos, it doesn't make sense to hold a manufacturer liable for dangers they could not even scientifically been aware of. So what Feldman says is, the Bichotta abolition of the state-of-the-art defense is limited to asbestos. And then this court said that again in Landrigan. So what you see is that in New Jersey, as we say in the brief, asbestos is different, and just always has been. But what plaintiffs want to do in this case is say, well, it's different for things like the defenses you can put on, but it's like the rest of New Jersey product liability law for liability. And we think that's contrary to the balance that this court was striking. And I think the balance is important. I mean, Schulstis says it, where they said what we're trying to do is we're trying to strike a balance so there's not too much liability on defendants, while at the same time ensuring that plaintiffs can have their day in court. And the court said it again in James when it adopted the regular, frequent, and proximate tests for all toxic torts. We don't want to have too much of an imbalance between liability on the one hand and impossibility of making your case on the other hand. And the rules that this court has established have, again, been working just fine for 3 decades. What plaintiff proposes is to really place a much greater burden on the asbestos multi-county litigation document by saying that if you can show that you worked around a Ford car or around a Crown boiler, you can survive essentially summary judgment, because everybody can put on the same proofs that the appellate division said below, because it's a relatively standard set of evidence that goes on in these cases.
But the defendant would not be entitled, because of Bashada, to the state-of-the-art defense.
That's
so that in
right.
other contexts, if there's a design defect claim that says this, there's an alternative safer design, the defendant can potentially counterbalance that with state-of-the-art. But in this situation, there the added liability would not be counteracted by the defense that would otherwise be available.
That's absolutely right. Even in a failure to warn case, you can say, well, we can't warn of something we don't know about. And in fact, that's what Feldman was about.
I understand why you're focusing so much on state-of-the-art, because it helps your position. But I don't know why we're not just coming back to James, which you just mentioned, which set a very simple test for how we look at a product and then apply it in a causation setting, which is how I think the appellate division tried to structure its analysis, not the way we're talking about now. The question, as the appellate division perceived it, was how do we define product, which is why some of us are asking a lot of questions focused on that angle of the case. So perhaps we could come back to that. What is wrong with taking the next step, as the appellate division did, and looking at product as the Maryland court did and some other states did, and say it's the entire thing that a manufacturer puts into the stream of commerce, knowing in those circumstances that there are expendable parts that involve products that are dangerous, for lack of a better term, asbestos, and it is known that these are parts that require replacement.
Well,
it's not that it can result in replacement with a defective part. It's known that these parts are expendable and will be replaced and will have to be handled in the context of continued use of the product that is put into the stream of commerce.
Sure. Well, first, I think, Your Honor, I think it's inconsistent with Bashada. But why shouldn't you go beyond Bashada, which is what I understand the question to
Correct.
Be, which is that, first, it throws out of balance the balance that I was just talking about with Justice Patterson, which is an equilibrium between liability on one hand for defendants and recovery for plaintiffs. And I think also it's inconsistent with the case law, because if you look at, if you look at the products that were at issue in the previous asbestos cases, I mean, Schultz's itself was about gaskets, it was about installations, it was about break, pipe covering and brake linings. So when Schultz says 3 times we need to focus on the friable asbestos, it was talking about the same kind of component parts that are at issue here. And so what Schultz, I guess, should have been saying was, one of the things that plaintiff says is, well, this case is unusual because it involves a complex multi-component machine. Very rarely are tradesmen just handling raw asbestos. They're working with asbestos-containing parts that they're putting on other things as insulation or as brake linings. So the cases
or gaskets or things or
like
fireboxes that require handling, maintenance, cleaning, that puts somebody in direct contact with the asbestos in that part of the product.
I think we're agreeing, but we're perhaps reaching different conclusions, which is that for 3 decades, New Jersey cases have been just like this one. And yet for 3 decades, according to plaintiff, just everyone had it wrong in their head, which is that what they should have been saying is, rather than being like, oh my goodness, I can't identify the manufacturer, what they should have been doing was identifying the boiler maker or the car maker.
Well, the point is that the issue has not been confronted until now. And so now we're deciding which way to go on it.
Well, I think the issue hadn't been confronted, because when you look at what Schultz says 3 times, it's hard to come out a different, it's just hard to sort of reach the place where plaintiffs are going.
And James was focused entirely on product being the product that's manufactured by the defendant. As a matter of fact, it's focused on manufacturing relationship entirely.
Absolutely. It was, in that case, it was solvents and other things. So it wasn't, the barrel that it came in or anything else like that. It was about what is the injury-producing element, which is what Hughes called it.
If you think about a failure to warn, and you have a product that has a replacement part that can either have the component such as asbestos in it or have some later invention, if you were to impose on a manufacturer of the original car, let's say, a duty to warn with respect to all later replacement component parts, which is what's being proposed here, you would essentially say that the manufacturer has to anticipate the state of the art going as long as the car is on the road. Could be 20 years.
Right. And not only do they have to anticipate the state of the art, they can't even talk about the state of the art.
Why state of the art? But you produce a product, a vehicle, that has asbestos-laden brakes. The only replacement part is asbestos-laden brakes. What is unfair about the manufacturer putting out a duty to warn that this is a dangerous product? Okay, we have a dangerous product, and the replacement parts will always be dangerous because that's the way we produce the car. What's unfair about that?
Well, I think what's unfair about that is, at least when it's our brakes, our asbestos, you know, Bashada says that there are certain policy considerations that would allow the defendant to be liable, even though it would have been scientifically impossible for them to know of the danger and thus to warn of it. But now you're then putting that same bar on raising the state of the art for everyone else's products, too. So essentially, you're becoming the insurer of the safety
no,
of
you,
everyone else's
you created product. A product that requires these, you know, these dangerous component parts. They were dangerous when you released the vehicle, and they'll be dangerous 5 years and 10 years from today, because that's the way you produce the vehicle. Why is it unfair that you should give a warning?
It's unfair, Justice Alvin, because we have the hypothetical duty to give that warning, even if it were impossible to know of the danger, thus making it essentially impossible to give a warning. And what Bashada says is, well, that trade-off is fair, because what we're saying is everybody's liable for their own asbestos. But when you start saying you're liable for everyone else's asbestos, and what you're saying is, look, you know, at the time we put out the car on the road, nobody knew. But maybe those folks, when they were putting out their replacement parts, they did know, and they should be putting warnings on it. But yet, what Bashada says, well, that doesn't matter. You're still liable. You're just liable for everyone's asbestos at all times, regardless of whether you knew or could have known of the danger.
Mr.
And that's the fundamental unfairness.
I think we understand your point on this issue. Is there something else you want to address? We're at the 30-minute mark and before you sit down.
Let me put it there unless anyone else has questions, and I'll see you on rebuttal.
Very good. Thank you. And to able co-counsel that are about to follow, to the extent you can incorporate Mr. Morata's fine arguments, please feel free to do so. Ms. Stanzion-Conte.
Thank you, Justices, and may it please the Court. On behalf of Crown Boiler Company and Cleveland Brooks, Inc., I do adopt the arguments presented by Mr. Morata. I just wanted to take a little bit of time to discuss facts specific to my client, to my clients, as it relates to what was identified in the appellate decision. And specifically as it relates to Crown Boiler, the record shows that during his discovery deposition, Mr. Whalen testified that he came into contact or at least saw Crown Boilers at certain sites while he owned his own business. He never worked on those boilers, he never saw anybody else work on those boilers, and he claimed that he wasn't exposed to asbestos as a result of those boilers. At his DeBene essay, he was asked if he ever worked on Crown Boilers, and he said that he cleaned about five or six of those boilers, and he performed work that was similar to the work he had done on other boilers. He also conceded at the DeBene essay that he had testified under oath that he wasn't exposed to asbestos from the Crown Boilers at his discovery deposition. We filed a motion for summary judgment. Motion was opposed with certain documents that included references to manuals, data sheets, and a deposition of our former corporate representative of Crown Boiler. The only document in all of the documents that were presented that noted anything about asbestos was a data sheet with regard to a Model F boiler. At oral argument, plaintiff was specifically asked about these documents and whether they related specifically to any boiler that Mr. Whalen, any Crown boiler that Mr. Whalen had come into contact with during his career, and the plaintiffs conceded that they couldn't say he identified any specific boiler that was referenced in these manuals. Further, the deposition testimony of our corporate representative that they relied on specifically noted that that data sheet for the F boiler that mentioned asbestos represented a boiler that Crown Boiler didn't sell until 1980. Based on that, the appellate court said that it was undisputed as to all defendants that plaintiff had proved that Crown Boiler marketed and sold an asbestos-containing product to which Mr. Whalen was exposed. And I submit that based on that information and the record below, that simply is not true. there is no indication that any of the boilers, the Crown boilers specific to that, that Mr. Whalen specifically came into contact with, were marketed and sold with an asbestos-containing part. And therefore, product causation as to Crown boiler was not met. As to Cleaver Brooks, if we're going to talk about a specific product, this, my client's specific product, the specific boiler to which Mr. Whalen was exposed, there's no evidence also in the record, and there's about 900 pages that plaintiff has presented regard, that includes, I believe, corporate representative depositions in other cases, not in the Whalen case, documents with regard to three different types of boilers, manuals. In fact, one of the manuals is dated 1976, which is after the time that Mr. Whalen even worked on the Crown Cleaver Brooks boiler. But again, at oral argument, plaintiff conceded none of these manuals or any of this information represents an exact Cleaver Brooks boiler that that Mr. Whalen had worked on.
But I thought Mr. Whalen, in his deposition, testified to a lot of detail about these pork chop boilers that Cleaver Brooks had. They were larger, 8 to 10 feet high, 8 to 12 feet long. It took 1 to 2 days to clean. That's a pretty detailed recollection. He was in those fireboxes cleaning them and also performing repairs. I thought what the appellate division was saying is that there was enough of a factual dispute to overcome the standard for summary judgment. That's all I was taking from their determination.
But their determination was based on documentation that wasn't relevant to this particular case. So if they allow that.
But I thought it was his testimony, his deposition testimony.
Right, but the standard is that they have to show that the boiler, as originally marketed and sold by Cleaver Brooks, contained asbestos. And there's no evidence in that, in this case, that the boiler that Mr. Whalen came into contact was marketed and sold with an asbestos-containing product. He only worked on the replacement. He himself only used the cement that it was supplied by his employer.
Okay. I understand your position. You're separating yourself from the replacement parts, including the asbestos cement that was used to fix the bricks that made the firebox that he had to go into and clean, correct?
Right, because there's no indication that Cleaver Brooks, he didn't know if anything was original to the boiler. He didn't know who supplied or manufactured the cement.
And this was something that had to be put together and had to be moved, as I recall.
Right, once it's installed, he then would go in and clean it up.
Scrub it with a brush that would make the dust, and yes,
correct.
All of that.
Mm-hmm. But there's no indication because, and I feel that the appellate court found product causation. I mean, they said it's undisputed that all of these defendants, that product causation was found as to all these defendants based on the fact that they marketed and sold asbestos-containing products in this case. And I don't, based on the evidence as to my two clients, I don't believe that that is necessarily true.
Understood.
Your comments illustrate a difficulty with replacement parts, especially in the asbestos context. You're dealing with asbestos cement. It's made by somebody. It's generally supplied through a supplier. If he owns his own business, he might be ordering it from a distributor. Obviously, in this case, there's a problem with product identification. But there may be zero nexus between your client's product and the manufacturer of that cement.
Absolutely. And also I see as an issue is if we allow this, then once a plaintiff at a deposition says, I worked on a so-and-so's boiler and I used an asbestos-containing part, then all the plaintiff has to do in opposition is show at some time, at some point, that boiler manufacturer or that manufacturer may have sold a boiler that contained asbestos. And some of these boiler manufacturers, my client included, sold 150,000 boilers over the course of its lifetime with all different models. Some contained asbestos, some did not. So I think that it almost shows absolute liability. It just gives them liability from the fact that just because they used they sold a boiler at one time, it may have been a time that's not even relevant to the case, they're going to be liable.
It puts the burden of product identification on the defendants.
Yes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Kluger.
you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, I am going to confine my remarks today, Justices, to a specific factual issue relevant only to my client, Armstrong International. There is a factual error, a simple factual error, which has made its way into the Appellate Division's decision concerning what my client's answers to standard asbestos interrogatories said. And that error is that the Appellate Division's decision says that Armstrong conceded in its answers to interrogatories that asbestos gaskets built into Armstrong's steam traps were necessary in order to create the proper seal for those gaskets. That's just not correct. And a simple look at the answer to interrogatory B15 will show what is actually said in those answers to interrogatories, which is...
Can you give us a record citation?
Record, yes. Plaintiff's Appendix 531, B14, and I quote from the B15, Your Honors. I quote from that answer, generally, comma, gaskets were necessary to ensure a tight fit and prevent leakage. So I think this goes directly to a concern that Justice Albin has raised today, which is the fairness or unfairness of finding a manufacturer liable for exposure to somebody else's product if that manufacturer's product was designed in such a way that the only feasible replacement part was an asbestos part. And that's a very relevant concern when it comes to Armstrong International. And the Appellate Division's decision has erroneously stated that was true of Armstrong's steam trap, but Armstrong has not conceded that in its answers to interrogatories. And the point is, whether it's true or not true, what the Appellate Division decision says is that Armstrong has conceded it, and it's conceded it because of what it said in its answers to interrogatories. It has not conceded it. All it has said is generally a gasket is required.
And this gaskets come in some different varieties,
they come
correct?
In different varieties. Some are asbestos, some are not. And the logical conclusion of what the Appellate Division's decision says is that anybody wanted to do the job right who was replacing a gasket in an Armstrong steam trap would have to use an asbestos gasket as the replacement gasket, otherwise a seal would not be effective. And that's not what the interrogatories say. That's not what the interrogatory answers say. And so the factual error, and this is not a matter of interpretation, it's a simple factual error, is about what is conceded in Armstrong International's answers to interrogatories. And it's clear on its face that it has not been conceded that an asbestos gasket is the only one that would do.
Understood. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I am going to confine my arguments this morning to the Appellate Division's treatment of the facts as found by the trial court as respects my client, Burnham, LLC. There is no dispute as to the standard of review to be applied by the Appellate Division. As this court found in the case of Templo Fuentes in 2016, orders granting summary judgment are reviewed de novo, applying the same standard as the trial court. And while review the trial court's interpretation of the law is not owed any special deference, the trial court's factual findings are to be accorded substantial deference. In fact, as this court said in Mashinsky from 1988, trial court findings are ordinarily not disturbed unless they are so wholly unsupportable as to result in a denial of justice and are upheld wherever they are supported by adequate, substantial, and credible evidence. Here, the trial court found or set forth an extensive recitation of undisputed material facts drawn from Mr. Whalen's deposition testimony, noting in particular that Mr. Whalen could not confirm whether Burnham boilers that he installed had asbestos in them, that he did not know when the Burnham boilers he repaired were installed or their maintenance histories, that he was not able to specifically say he was exposed to asbestos in connection with his repair of Burnham boilers, and he could not say without guessing if he was exposed to asbestos in connection with the conversion of Burnham boilers. Notwithstanding all of that, the appellate division addressing Burnham LLC and another defendant, Carrier, at the same time.
Can you give us a page citation in the appellate division decision? Don't worry about it.
Thank you.
We'll get it from you later.
Yes, absolutely. So notwithstanding, the appellate division addressing both Burnham and Carrier together made contradictory factual findings, including...
Can I stop you there just for one moment?
Sure.
This is a summary judgment motion.
Yes.
I thought in the summary judgment motion, the court is not making factual findings. It's looking at the evidence in light most favorable to the non-moving party. Am I mistaken about that?
No, not at all. That is the case. But the court below, the trial court, set forth facts that Mr. Whalen himself testified to.
I read this, and I did find it. I read this as the appellate division saying that the court presented these facts as undisputed, but as we read the record, you know, on the appellate standard for summary judgment, we see statements by plaintiffs that would create a genuine issue of material fact. That's how I read it. I didn't see it as a rejection of findings necessarily. I thought it was a disagreement with the trial court as to whether there were facts that were undisputed as to your client.
We view it as the appellate court disagreeing with the trial court.
But it can. On summary judgment motion, our standard review is de novo. We could look at the transcripts and the evidence just like the trial court in the light most favorable to non-moving party and make our own determinations, because these are not factual determinations. I think this is one of the points that Justice Patterson was just making.
Understood. Burnham, however, would suggest that it was error for the appellate division to make contradictory decision as to Burnham, and we would submit that summary judgment was warranted as to Burnham on the facts presented.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Plessitella.
Morning, Justices. I have the privilege and honor to represent Arthur Whalen in this appeal through his daughter, Kimberly Spitz. Arthur Whalen was devastated in injury and mortality as a result of his work as a plumber, repairing equipment manufactured and sold by these defendants, and working on brakes from Ford vehicles. Significant in this case and at the heart of this case is the fact that, from the plaintiff's perspective, the danger of asbestos exposure was inherent in the operation and maintenance of the equipment. And the facts are important, and I won't go into all of them, but by way of brief overview, this equipment was designed to last many years at a significant market price. The asbestos components were integral to the functioning of the equipment. The equipment was not saleable without asbestos. It did not work without asbestos. And it was the equipment that carried the asbestos into the stream of commerce. The long-term life of the equipment required maintenance that caused the exposure. And what's very important in this case is that the danger of asbestos exposure was created by the equipment itself. The products at issue, the asbestos products at issue, many of them were encapsulated. Most of them were internal to the equipment. And if the equipment was never turned on, there would have been no exposure, because it was the operation of the equipment, the heat, and the pressure that was exerted by that equipment that created the danger. And it was the intended maintenance of that equipment that caused Mr. Whalen's asbestos exposure. So the equipment itself carried into the stream of commerce the danger of exposure. And the defect that we're alleging is, it's important to understand the defect that we're alleging. The defect we're alleging is that the defendant's failure to warn that the routine maintenance or dismantling of the equipment that required asbestos pose a serious risk of exposure without proper precautions. Now, there are two types of exposure in this case. I had a longer argument, but counsel for Ford took that away. The first part was if Mr. Whalen was exposed to original asbestos when he worked on some of this equipment. In fact, if you look at the second to last paragraph of the appellate division's decision in Whalen, they clearly say that Ford was responsible for the original replacement parts. Ford, in his brief and here today, takes no issue with that. So as to Ford, this case should be remanded for trial on that basis alone. The second part of this case and where this appeal focuses is in the circumstances where Mr. Whalen was exposed, but he was unable to prove that the asbestos that he was taking out or working on was the same exact asbestos as was put in to begin with. It could have been, but because he was the person doing repairs, he would have no ability to do that. But he can prove that it was sold with asbestos, that it was integral to the functioning, and that they knew that replacement would have to take place. It's also significant, I submit, that there is no legal precedent in the state for the defendant's position of no duty. The holdings, here we have both the Whalen court and the Hughes court unanimous in that a duty is owed. And we submit that that duty is consistent with cases that have been decided by this court and the appellate division as set forth in detail in our brief. Because under New Jersey law, responsibility attaches to foreseeable use, foreseeable misuse, but here we have intended use. And the Supreme Court of the United States, under far less compelling circumstances than here, agrees that a duty was owed. In the Supreme Court, what happened was the Navy specified the asbestos, not the equipment manufacturers, and the asbestos was added after it left the control of the equipment manufacturer. Yet the interesting part is that the Supreme Court actually looked at the appellate division decision in Whalen, and even the dissent went out of its way, the U.S. Supreme Court, to say that under the circumstances of Whalen, they would impose liability because it's clear that where the product is integral and sold as part of the original sale, they should be responsible.
Can I stop it for a second?
Mm-hmm.
It's from a practical standpoint.
Yes.
Are you familiar with how brakes work? The difference between disc and drum brakes?
Somewhat, yes.
Okay. Disc is a disc, and then there's a horseshoe-looking thing on top, and the pads come out.
Yes.
Drums is self-contained, and the brake parts are inside.
Yes.
All right. Now, when those parts are being used, the asbestos from the brake drums, it accumulates inside the drum.
Correct.
Okay. So when the drum is taken off, in order to replace the pads inside with the springs and the clip, as opposed to disc brakes, that dust comes into the air, right?
That's correct. And you make the exact point that I'm trying to make, and that is that it's the manufacturer of the equipment that creates the hazard. Because until Mr. Whalen has to go inside that brake...
I just thought I'd make it easier for you.
Yes. Thank you for the softball, Your Honor. Because if Mr. Whalen has to clean out that brake, that's where the exposure occurs. And policy reasons...
Let me stop you there, if I may, Mr. Plasitella. Why don't you assert a design defect claim, saying that there was, at the time of the manufacture of the Ford, an alternative, safer way to manufacture brakes that would not involve asbestos?
Because we don't have to prove. We don't have to. All we're saying is, tell the people, give them the opportunity to protect themselves. The plaintiff is the
I understand
master,
you're not. I understand
the,
you're not.
The master, the plaintiff is the master of his pleadings and his theory of his case.
Completely.
Yes.
Completely. All due respect.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. But the fact is that what you're suggesting here is that there was something wrong with the way that the product was designed so that it according to your theory, would not work without asbestos.
What I'm suggesting is that if you're going to use a product, that you need to warn about it. The law is very clear in Michalko, all the way back to Bexiga. If there's a dangerous piece of equipment and a warning will lessen the risk, then you should warn about it.
But that's the product that the manufacturer made.
Well,
let's just pause here, because are you not acknowledging that there's anything new about this theory?
No, I actually don't think there's anything new, because we're talking about the failure to warn of the product being the machine. And that danger would not occur but for the operation of the machine. And think about it, Justice Patterson. In the Roe case, the defendants came before this court, the same defendants, and they argued that they could seek apportionment from the co-defendants, by the way, relying on Bishada, right?
Sure.
Simply because...
Nobody's fighting over Bishada.
No, simply because the defendants specified asbestos to be included in their boilers. So in the Roe case, they came forward and they said, we can get apportionment from the defendants by showing all they did was specify the asbestos. But here they say you can't hold us responsible. And there's good policy reasons why.
The Roe case, the theory of both the plaintiff and the defendants in the Roe case is different from the theory that's being asserted against Ford.
Not necessarily. What happened in the Roe case was he was a boiler repairman just like Mr. Whalen. And he actually also repaired cars. And what happened in the Roe case is when it got to the jury charge stage, there was an argument. And the plaintiff was actually trying to keep evidence out. And the court there said, no, if the defendant specified asbestos, and if you look even at the language in Roe, sold and or specified. So even in the Roe case, if you specified asbestos, whether or not you sold it, you are responsible. That's the argument they made the last time they were here. Now they say this is new. It is not new. I heard counsel for the defendants say, the plaintiffs, this is all new. The boiler defendants have been in this litigation. I had dark curly hair when it started. and the truth of the matter is, and it shows in Roe, that theory is not new. The theory that they designed a product that was defective and they sold it with asbestos is not new. That was the basis for their seeking apportionment.
Obviously, I'm familiar with the Roe record
that
we had. The Roe record before us does not involve this particular issue.
I understand that. Yeah. But I only say that by way of example, because this is not a new theory. And when they say Bishada is unfair, well, the defendants rely upon Bishada every day. It has served both sides of the aisle well for more than four decades. When we go to trial, the defendants rely upon Bishada. They say, keep that knowledge stuff out. It will inflame the jury. Or we don't have to prove knowledge to prove our apportionment claim because that's not required under New Jersey law.
Can I ask you one question?
Yes.
Do you agree that the state-of-the-art defense is not available with respect to asbestos cases in New Jersey?
I believe that. It was the very first case I ever worked on in my career, so I know it well. And yes, I do agree with that.
Okay. So that when you talk about a defective product, you're relying in a sense on Bishada to say, is state-of-the-art available in any other product liability setting besides asbestos?
It's available in some cases. And I agree
when
with that.
Where is it not available? Besides asbestos.
Given. But the court here made a policy decision. Which
I get you. I'm just trying to be really
yes,
narrow.
Yes, I agree with you.
Okay, so when these products were sold, are you disputing that they knew at the time that asbestos was a defective product?
No, I'm not disputing. I know that they knew
at the time that these boilers were made and these vehicles were made, the traditional notion of product defect, that is, the state-of-the-art defense, existed. What I'm saying is, if the state-of-the-art defense existed here,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't have a case, would you?
I absolutely would, because okay. even if this court were to decide not to follow Bechata and to apply Feldman, the burden then just shifts to the defendants to prove that the danger was unknowable.
But Feldman makes clear you don't have to worry about that. Feldman makes clear that in an asbestos case, you don't have to worry about
correct.
You know, Bechata now applying.
Correct.
No dispute at all about the application.
Correct.
But even if this court, are you prepared to say that if they can come in and show that at the time this product, the car, the boiler, was manufactured, there was not a product that could replace asbestos? In other words, are you suggesting that if we decide in your favor, we can leave open to them the state-of-the-art defense?
Well, you can
vault it.
You are the Supreme Court.
No,
you
can.
You could make the decision.
Oh, we could do anything.
You could make the decision. Exactly.
And I used to have dark curly
hair. You could
make
the decision. You could clearly make the decision not to apply Bechata in these circumstances, but to apply Feldman. You could do that.
Yeah,
but
I understand.
Right.
And that, I guess that's what you're asking us to do. Don't give them the state-of-the-art.
I'd be stunned if Mr. Pasatel asked us not to apply Bechata.
That you should keep Bechata as it is.
Right.
You could make the decision.
But I guess what you're suggesting is don't give them the state-of-the-art defense, but expose them to product liability just like any other product.
No. If this court determined that you believe that Feldman should apply under these circumstances, you could do that. It won't change the end result, I submit. And even if you did that...
That issue's not before
right.
the court.
I
think we can assume okay. there's no question this is a Bechata case.
Okay.
There is no state-of-the-art. They wouldn't have the defense of the state-of-the-art. And there's no design defect in terms of an alternative safer design anywhere in the case.
That's not being pled.
A product defect case is not necessarily mutually exclusive from a failure to warn case, correct?
No, in fact, there have been many statements by the court that a failure to warn case in this context is akin to a design defect case.
You could have filed both. You could have filed one or the other. You have decided to file a failure to warn case.
That's correct.
Okay,
we also have a negligence case, which is not before the court. But the policy reasons, whether you would decide Bechata should apply or not, the policy reasons here for imposing a duty under these circumstances are significant. And the reason I say that is what... The company that's in the best position to warn here is the company that specified the asbestos for its intended life. The defendants are in the best position as the seller of the equipment, as the master of their equipment, to put a warning either on the product, in a manual. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court said as much. They said under far less compelling circumstances, even looking at Whalen, that the policy for having the equipment manufacturer, because they know how their product is going to be used. The component part manufacturer may not know all the uses. And, you know,
if you had this component part manufacturer, you'd be all over that defendant. You would have them in court. You would be arguing to the jury that they made these replacement gaskets or whatever they may be, the replacement brakes. And you do it routinely, right? If you can identify that component part manufacturer, you say New Jersey imposes a duty to warn on manufacturers of component parts, and you didn't warn.
That's true, Your Honor.
And you
but
would,
under
you
these
would,
circumstances...
No, I understand that. Right. But just to be clear, it's not. Right. You started to sound like you were exonerating component part.
I am not.
And I was trying to stop you
what
from,
I'm, no,
from doing
it. I am not.
Because
I am
you,
not. But what I am saying
but the,
is...
But the point is right. that if you can identify that component part manufacturer, you use traditional concepts of failure to warn that say you are the manufacturer or the distributor or the seller of this specific component part, therefore you are liable. And you don't bother with the other theory because you don't have to.
No, I absolutely do. Yeah. Every time under these circumstances, and I'll tell you why. Because under these circumstances, the only entity that's capable of providing the warning to Mr. Whalen is the equipment company. Mr. Whalen has no idea whose product is in there. He has no idea of the dangers that are in that product.
So if he's working as a professional installing a boiler, he goes to his distributor and he gets a component, he has to replace a part of a boiler, he gets a product that's made by somebody.
Correct.
Right? And so that product, according to your theory, if you can identify that product, your argument is that they should have warned that product manufacturer.
Absolutely. That does not derogate from the defendant's ability to warn, because suppose Mr. Whalen only did this big job one time. He went in and it was a boiler laden with asbestos. And he went in, he scraped it out with his brush. He has no ability to identify that defendant. They know whose product they put in their boiler originally. Mr. Whalen does not.
I take it your position, too, is that just because the supplier may not give a warning about the dangers of asbestos in its component part does not relieve the manufacturer of its responsibility to warn.
Absolutely. And if you look at these circumstances, if you take the defendant's argument to its logical conclusion, somebody who is repairing their equipment or maintaining their equipment, if he doesn't do it, installation, he's just there to do repairs or clean it out, he will never, ever be warned about the dangers that are inherent in the equipment to begin with. Right? If his job is only to go in, he's a laborer that works for Mr. Whalen, and what he does is he goes in and he just takes his wire brush and he scrapes out the inside of the Cleaver Brooks boiler. Right? Under their theory of the case, he will never receive a warning because he never touched a replacement part, even assume it had a warning on it, which they pretty much did not. Right? He'll never be warned.
They want
you to impose to relieve them of duty and leave the innocent plaintiff with no remedy. Because that's the end result.
Just factually, when their warnings in the 1970s, when warnings started to appear on asbestos products, did they start to appear on the boxes of replacement parts?
They appeared on some defendants' products.
I'm not talking about, I'm leaving aside
on
the case.
On some
this
defendants'
is a general...
products, yes, on most, on many, they never appeared, even though it was clearly they had knowledge. Some of the defendants' products, by the way, they had warnings on the products, and the manufacturers of the equipment took them off when they resold the asbestos. And I'm talking about car companies.
No, okay.
Okay?
But that kind of
proves the point.
Right, but we're talking about replacement parts that came from distributors and were installed in older machinery, sometimes had warnings that were not put on when the machinery was made, the car was made, the boiler was made back in the 1960s.
That happened, yes, that happened.
That happened.
It happened infrequently, not as much as we would have liked to protect people, but it did happen. But the point here is, it was the machine, it was the piece of equipment that created the hazard. There would have been no hazard but for that machine. Right?
So
if the product was unsaleable without it, and if the machine was never turned on and Mr. Whalen was never asked to repair it, he would still be alive today.
How about if the original brake pads were not as non-asbestos containing? There was some other matter that... Would you still be arguing the same case today because the replacement parts contained asbestos, even though the original product parts did not contain asbestos?
No, I would not be arguing because that's not the law as set forth by the Appellate Division. The Appellate Division's articulation of this case was pretty narrow, I would submit, and clearly not absolute liability, as Ford argues. In fact, if you look at the circumstances...
Isn't that what Hughes actually said? If the original parts did not contain, that
the hazardous product and there's no liability for the product?
That's what you says. That's what you says. And in fact, there can't be absolute liability here. And the circumstances are very narrowly circumscribed. First, you have to satisfy the three-part use test, right? That was echoed by our U.S. Supreme Court in large part. Then the defendant still gets to come forward under Becker and argue, even if historical knowledge is not in the case, we, Ford, contest that our product can cause any injury and that it's dangerous. In fact, they do that in virtually every case. So they are still given the ability under our law, despite Bishada, to come forward with proof that says, under these circumstances, our product isn't dangerous.
But you're saying Hughes was wrongly decided on the core issue before the court today.
The core issue before the court, I believe, is duty, and I believe it was correctly decided. What Hughes did, respectfully to the Hughes court, is they gave with one hand and they took with the other. There was a disconnect. Mm-hmm. They called the whole integrated product the product for defining duty, and then when they went to causation, they ignored the fact that it was the product, that it was the integrated product that was responsible for the exposure, mm-hmm. and they found no causation because the plaintiff couldn't identify.
But you agree that one of your proofs is that the replacement parts are asbestos laden.
Absolutely. And if they weren't, we would be here doing something very different. So what we have here, so yes, we believe the basic part of Hughes was correct, that the court went through a very good analysis, tracked many other cases, and then kind of made a right turn at the end of the case and disconnected the last page of the opinion from everything that came before
that. Can you give us an example? Machine cases, obviously there are huge varieties of medical devices, of anybody defining products to include a hazard created by a replacement part. Obviously, thinking of all those safety guard cases where, you know, a machine's been around a long time and there's a new safety guard put in, if it's not a design defect that where the design calls for a particularly dangerous safety guard, and obviously there's a design defect theory that can be made out of that, where is there a failure to warn duty imposed for a hazard that's created by that replacement part?
Well, if you start with the premise that if you specify what will be in the product as a basis for liability, which is part of the used part of the Whalen test, then that actually is found in the Roe case at the trial court level, because, and even as set forth in this case, if the
let's talk about cases generally, because anything that's done in this case could have major ramifications for New Jersey product liability law generally,
right?
And you're happy about that?
I'll tell you after I see your decision.
So where is there an example from a setting anywhere where the hazard's created by the replacement part? It's not a design defect that's based on specification of a dangerous product. It's a failure to warn claim, and the warning is imposed on the manufacturer who neither manufactured the replacement part or sold the machine or whatever it may be with the replacement part in it.
I don't think that this court has squarely dealt with that issue.
Can you give us any example in product liability?
Well, I could look right at the Molino and Seeley case where the court recognizes that when you put two products together.
Different issue, you got to admit. That's totally different.
I really don't think it's different, because again, we're talking about the machine creating the hazard.
But both
the equipment is what creates the hazard.
But the combined
need to maintain the equipment. That asbestos gasket, if it was left in the machine and the machine was only had a useful life of 6 months, let's say in this case, it only had 6 months, and then they threw it out, right? That hazard would have never been created.
I understand.
The reason it was created was because the machine, by virtue of its circumstances creates the hazard.
You made the point very articulately. But
did I convince you, though?
No, okay. I got to tell you, you didn't, because you didn't answer my question.
Okay.
So my question is, where else in product liability law is product defined to include the manufacturer, the seller, the distributor, plus the manufacturer of a product that later has a hazard put into it in a replacement part?
The U.S. Supreme Court in DeVry.
Okay. Talking about New Jersey law, because I am no expert on maritime law that's there, but New Jersey law has a number of very New Jersey-specific components, most of which help plaintiffs, some of which help defendants. So that's what I need to hear, is why is this not new in New Jersey? Where has this been done before?
A case for this court on that specific issue of the replacement part, it's a case you're looking at for the first time. It's not new if you're looking at the product as a whole. And that's my point, mm-hmm. that if you want to just peel out the replacement part issue, but that's not what's going on here. What's going on here, respectfully, is that it's the equipment that caused the danger. The product itself didn't cause the danger. If it was never worked on and the machine was never turned on, there would have been no danger. In fact, these defendants make that argument. They say our product was encapsulated, didn't cause the danger. The reason the danger occurred was because of how the equipment operated. And the only entity that is capable of knowing that is the equipment manufacturer. The parts manufacturer can't. They don't know every possible use that their product would be put in.
Let me give you just an example. Let me just
excuse
give
me.
You.
Brake drum?
Brake drum again, thank you.
No, but I'm saying, yes. They don't know?
They absolutely
It's not going to be used in an operating room.
Yeah, a brake drum is a different.
That's what we have here.
Is a different animal. And as you heard, Ford has now conceded that this case must go back to the trial court because they're responsible for the original brake drums that Mr. Whalen...
That's not the issue, really, that's here. Let me just give you an example. Let's say there's a very good safety guard put on an industrial machine.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in a workplace setting. So all of the law that applies to workplace setting applies here, okay? And let's say somebody promotes a safety guard as a replacement to the old safety guard that's just a whole lot easier to remove and keeps production going faster. We've all read cases kind of like that, okay? So, it leaves the manufacturer's plant with a very good safety guard on it, but 10 years later, somebody's marketing this quick and easy safety guard that your folks can remove and you're going to move production faster. Is the manufacturer of the original machine liable for failure to warn of the dangers of that safety guard?
Well, that goes down to the issue of whether it's foreseeable misuse. For example, if the safety guard was made so you could remove it easily, then a good case could be made that there was a obligation to warn there. If it was welded on and it took a yeoman's effort to get that off and it was not a foreseeable thing that would happen,
The danger is created by this new safety guard that's easy to remove. 10 years later, manufacturer of the machine has nothing to do with it. May not even know about it.
I would submit that our case law would impose a duty on that manufacturer if the manufacturer knew that the safety guard was easily removed and that without it, it could present a serious hazard. You know, if you look at our policy, which is warn where it doesn't take anything, if you look at Michalko, the circumstances there, where
I'm sorry.
And take away the
I'm not saying it's the one it installed. I'm talking about a later invention. You're saying that there's a duty to warn for a later safety guard that's manufactured by somebody entirely different, that is different from the original one and makes it easier to take.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
I was suggesting.
You're asking, just so I have it clear, you're asking if a different type of safety guard was put on other than that was already there.
Right. The one that was originally there is already there. There's a later replacement.
I think that's different. That's like answering the question, later on they put non-asbestos-containing product into the Cleaver Books boiler because they figured out how to do that.
Your argument is that these cars, these other products, had built-in wear and tear that were going to require replacement, not new things, replacement of the very parts that they already had, and they were all asbestos.
That's exactly right, Justice Alvin, because what happened here was there was never a time, other than when the old piece of gasket might have been in Mr. Whalen's hands, falling out all over his clothes, there was never a time when the products at issue here did not have asbestos. It's not a situation later on where somebody takes it out and puts something else in. It was specified, and that was why I believe even the U.S. Supreme Court went further than Whalen and said, where the manufacturer specifies that asbestos must be used, we are going to hold the equipment manufacturer, for all the policy reasons we talked about, to a duty to warn. And in fact, that's what the trial court actually did in the Roe case.
We're a little beyond the allotted time.
I'm sure we are.
Before you sit, do you want to address any of the factual arguments that were raised very briefly?
I would say this, Chief Justice. There are disputes as to the facts. And what the appellate division did here is they looked at the law as they thought it should be, and they applied the disputed facts, the facts as it were presented, and said under those circumstances, summary judgment should not be granted. That's exactly the test that you articulated, I believe, in the James case. So it's not necessary at this point to address the factual issues, because the only thing that they demonstrated, respectfully, was that there is a genuine issue of material fact between what the plaintiffs say the proofs are and what they say the proofs are. And if that's the issue, then the case should be sent back for trial. I appreciate your patience, particularly you, Justice Patterson. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Long.
May it please the court. The decision of the appellate division here and also the panel in Hughes on the issue of duty to warn is well grounded in New Jersey jurisprudence. And this comes from cases such as Mchalko, where the court found that if a defect which singly or in combination caused the injury existed before as well as after the change, the manufacturer is not relieved of liability regardless of how much the product has been changed. And so the liability for the replacement parts here that may have been manufactured by another company is grounded in our jurisprudence that says that substantial changes to a product will not relieve a manufacturer for a duty to warn if that substantial change is not what caused the defect.
But Mchalko was very different. Mchalko was answering a different question.
It was answering a different question, Your Honor, and
this situation didn't arise in Mchalko.
It is a different situation, but I think it's grounded in the same fundamental principles that when a defendant makes a product that's defective and that it contains that defect when it leaves their control, that they're liable to, they're responsible that for that product. They have a duty to warn regardless of if there's substantial change. And
their product. I mean, the Mchalko product was just a different, a very different situation.
It was a different situation, and I think the Seeley case is another case that illustrates and explains why there should be liability for the replacement parts here. And Seeley, I think, is an example when, Justice Patterson, you were asking for an example where a defendant's been held liable for a replacement part. In Seeley, a mechanical foot pedal that was originally installed in the product when it left the manufacturer's control was replaced by an electronic pedal, which made it easier for the machine. The mechanical pedal was difficult to press, and the electronic pedal was very easy to press. And the court discussed that where it was located near the press was part of what made it dangerous, because it was easy to push the pedal while having one's hand in the press. And that was a replacement not originally installed by the manufacturer.
And the court there.
Right, but the defect in Sealy was the way the machine was structured, so that it was just so easy for somebody to be injured having their hand nearby.
Correct, Your Honor. But with the
and that was a design defect. That was a design defect case.
It was a failure to warn case.
Yeah,
it had a design defect component and a failure to warn.
Right, but there was a design defect claim there. If I remember correctly, I haven't read it. I didn't read it in preparation for this. Based upon the ability to design that product in a different way, so that the pressure on the foot would not endanger the person's hand.
That was part of the design defect claim. But
right.
The court in Sealy also rejected the defendant's claim that because major components of the machine had been replaced by the time, because Sealy involved a continuing duty to warn, so by the time that the defendant's representative saw the machine in the place where it injured the plaintiff, the court rejected that there was no duty to warn because of the replacement of substantial parts, and it said that the specific replacements either were irrelevant to the accident or could reasonably have been contemplated by the defendant. And here, the asbestos components, which has been discussed widely, were known would be replaced. It certainly was foreseeable to the defendants that when they incorporated asbestos-containing components into their product, that would be replaced with asbestos.
Yeah, but I mean, the analogy would be in Sealy is if the injury was to the foot for using the pedal. And I think I frankly don't think the Sealy case would have gone that way because that was somebody else's pedal.
Well, and I think it was a combination, Your Honor, of how much easier it was to push the pedal and its location near the press. So if it's going to be easy to press,
yeah, but the danger was created at the hand
enough.
Level. The danger is the person's hand being too easily injured
while they're pushing the pedal.
While they're pushing the pedal.
But I do think that the replacement of the mechanical pedal with the electronic pedal made that accident more likely, and the court found that the fact that that pedal had been replaced did not absolve from the duty to warn. In addition, in the Zaza case, the court noted that component part manufacturers could still be held liable for injury caused by defective components where the defects in the component part and did not undergo substantial change after leaving the manufacturer's hand. So there's well-grounded precedents in New Jersey, and this is what both the Hughes Court and the Whalen panel below relied on for finding that it was completely appropriate to impose a duty to warn on the defendants here. Similarly, or to address the argument that this case or that imposing liability on the defendants under the circumstances required by the court is in conflict with Bishada. It is not. Bishada only applies to the knowledge of the hazards of asbestos. And when we're talking about whether it was foreseeable that the product would be replaced with another asbestos-containing product, that is not a negligence analysis. That's a foreseeability of the users and foreseeable uses. So it's not adding negligence principles to a strict liability claim. It's simply looking at a different aspect of that claim, different from Bishada, which is...
I think the argument as to Bishada is a little bit different, and that is that asbestos manufacturers are subject to a very, very difficult standard in the sense that it's for policy reasons that the court articulated. It's a very easy case to prove if you know who your asbestos manufacturer is. I'm not asking you to agree with that, but
sure.
It can be difficult at times.
Well, it is.
But their defenses are not available to the asbestos manufacturer.
Sure.
So that the argument I think I'm hearing over here is that having taken away that state-of-the-art defense, what the court's being asked to do is to extend that liability to someone who didn't manufacture the asbestos.
Sure. Well, in the circumstances that the Whalen court allows for this duty to be imposed, the manufacturer had to include asbestos components in the original product as delivered. So that Bishada's imputed knowledge is already there. Your Honor.
It's already there, and they're conceding that they are potentially on the hook for the asbestos that's in the product when it leaves.
And so the product had to have that warning. If the plaintiff who was here before you was the person who removed that first product, and they were injured by that first removal of the product, there would be no question they had a duty to warn and that they could be responsible
to
the
manufacturer. They're selling the product with the asbestos in it.
And the fact that a product, a known needed to be replaced component, was replaced with an equally dangerous component that is substantially the same as the one that they put in that product, and that the person who happened to be injured was the 20th person to work on that product instead of the very first, should not change these manufacturers' duty to warn.
It's basically a
windfall for them that the person who was injured happened to be the second person to replace the part rather than the very first.
Their argument is we're not the manufacturers. We didn't manufacture the dangerous product.
Well, and that
so
would
that's
be,
their argument.
I mean, essentially what the court in Hughes found when it found that the product had to be the asbestos-containing product. Respectfully, I think that was a misapplication of Schultes and its progeny, because those cases never addressed this question. And if you're going to address such an important question, it shouldn't be because the language of a case that was addressing a totally separate issue uses the words friable asbestos, because Schultes was dealing with known manufacturers of products, largely asbestos-containing insulation, that were all in one workplace, and what intensity of exposure you have to those products to meet a medical causation standpoint.
But your point is well taken. I mean, in colloquy with me, counsel was suggesting that we have to keep hermetically sealed the negligence analysis from the strict liability analysis. My words, not counsel's. But, I mean, and when we were talking about the Maryland case, this had come up. So I understand your use of the negligence concept for foreseeability as you're explaining it. Doesn't it also come up in causation analysis in strict liability as well as it did in the Becker case, where some negligence aspects were brought into causation in a strict liability setting?
They are to the extent, I mean, the only change in strict liability occasioned by Bashada is the knowledge of the hazards of asbestos. Mm-hmm. The remaining elements of the causation of the claim, and our courts say that besides the proving knowledge, negligence and strict liability failure to warn claims are essentially the same.
Right.
So certainly there are principles of
that they do. There's a synergy there.
It's exactly, and really the big difference is the knowledge imputed. And I think because the Whalen court below required that the original product have asbestos in it when it left their control, that solves that imputation of knowledge
issue.
Because that's already imputed.
Please draw your argument too close.
Okay. The only other thing I would say is that all of the cases that have been discussed today, Bashada, Hughes, cases that are cited, Kaufman, Zaza, all of these cases rely on the principle that when a defendant manufactures a defective product, here the integrated product with the asbestos-containing component parts, that it is fair and proper to put the risk, the cost of the injuries associated with that product on the manufacturer, and not to impose the costs of those of the hazardous product on innocent workers and people who are exposed to that product. And in cases like this, if they don't have the liability, it will be the plaintiffs who are assuming the costs of their products.
Thank you. And thank you to all counsel. You're standing? Were you? No, we're good. I thought you were indicating you wanted to offer rebuttal, which you had not reserved, and that's fine. Thank you to all counsel for the very fine arguments, and I thank the defense in particular for coordinating your arguments so well. We're going to take a brief recess and come back for the next matter.